On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Let the reader beware, warns novelist Thomas Pynchon, before the reader even begins Pynchon's vast new novel, Against the Day. And then we're off on a mad caper that can only be described, of course, as Pynchonesque. Starting high above the Chicago World's Fair of 1893 in a plummeting dirigible, then into the blue with anarchists, gamblers, magicians, spies, villains, shamans, and hired guns. Ever since V and Gravity's Rainbow, Thomas Pynchon has been a cult hero and provocateur, as reclusive as J.D. Salinger, as complex as Hieronymus Bosch, called the greatest, wildest, most infuriating author of his generation. Up next on Point, the life and wild message of reclusive novelist Thomas Pynchon. We will hear in this hour from two top Pynchon scholars, and we'll hear a bit of one of Thomas Pynchon's very rare public appearances, a few lines read on The Simpsons. But first, joining me from New York City is Liesl Schillinger. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review. She recently reread all of Thomas Pynchon's novels before writing an enthusiastic review of his latest book, Against the Day. Liesl Schillinger, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
I love your description here of the idiosyncratic genius, the daring of the unanswerable questions and accusations hurled onto the page like a carnival knife thrower who didn't care if his blade impaled his target. You're all for the guy all these years on.
Well, actually, you know, that's how I saw his earlier novels, kind of before
right.
this one.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it was kind of interesting the way he addressed the horrors of the 20th century, the same ones that people like Günter Grass and Vonnegut and Heller did, without seeming to be all that dismayed himself. And so I marked a real difference in this one. But, you know, whatever his attitude was, I've always been captivated by his labyrinthine writing, his illusions, and his cryptic it's just his cryptic framings. They just kill me.
We've got almost 1,100 pages here. I've waded deep into it, but I have to admit I didn't get around the final bend before we went
For
on
shame.
Air today. Yeah. Well, I mean, but it's got me kind of hooked. I think I'm going to stick with this one. You know, the reviewers, one after another, kind of have different views on this. People always are polarized by Pynchon. You've given it a pretty good thumbs up here. You've got Michiko Kakutani also at the Times calling this a humongous, bloated jigsaw puzzle of a story, elliptical without being illuminating, and right on down. What do you think?
Well,
yes?
Yes, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No,
but,
please, go ahead.
Yeah, no, there has been a kind of a convulsion of critics against this one. And one thing I wonder about is, you know, maybe the difference is that a lot of them really prefer the style of the earlier ones, which are harder to pick out than this one. I think there's a way in which the denseness and the complicatedness of his writing the other ones made his message more interesting because it was less discernible. And I'm wondering whether now, as I think at least, what he's saying is a little clearer. People are kind of like, oh, is that all there is? Whereas, I mean, I'm certainly not saying this is an easy read. I'm just saying he doesn't really bury his thoughts quite as deep.
We'll look at what he's saying and how it may be more overt here. But here's a challenge for you. Try and convey a sense of this book. You know, the old question, what it's about. It's about all kinds of things, and it's interesting. Every review, it's like the blind man and the elephant. I mean, every review is kind of a different telling of what it's about. But for readers who haven't cracked it at all yet, how would you begin to describe Thomas Pynchon's latest, Against the Day?
The first thing I would say is that it has a sense of humor, and people are always talking about the sense of humor in his previous books, which frankly didn't get a lot of belly laughs out of me, although I laughed wryly at a lot of them. They can be very dark, though. This one, though, is whimsical. It's humorous, and it begins pretty intentionally in the cheering tone of boy's own adventure, and
that is the kind of books for young boys written quite a while back, the sort of
like
boosterish.
Like The Fabulous Five or Tom Swift. It's
yeah.
The young boy hero or scientist can take on the world. And his young boys are called the Chums of Chance, and they float above the earth in a hydrogen airship, kind of observing what goes on below and completing fatuous missions, which they don't understand, and they're kind of ageless. But as this book gets going, they're sort of King's, their King's X, their free zone, kind of disappears as the horror of the First World War begins to build. So it's basically the intersection of this kind of humorous, adventurous, childish narrative of adventure mixed with the mounting horror of the upcoming First World War. And that gets... Are you asking me to summarize Pynchon? This is like Monty Python summarizing Shakespeare in a sentence.
Well, just throw out a few more threads there so we can get a sense of the plot there. I mean, you've got anarchists in Colorado and their sons looking for revenge and arch-villains.
Yeah. Well, the basic idea is there progress? I think that would be the question that this is supposed to be answering, this book. You know, on the verge of the 20th century, the technological, you know, culmination of man, is there going to be good stuff going on? Is there a role for young heroes? And the answer, in short, is no. Sinister capitalists are controlling humans and subverting their desires for their own capitalist ends. Angry anarchists are fighting them with dynamite and so forth. And the anarchists kind of join up with some psychic physicists in Europe and England and Germany in a kind of vast amorphous spy network to try to find the answer to how the dehumanizing capitalists, think of them as the WTO of the turn of the century, can be outfoxed and humanity can be saved, and how maybe the war can be understood and to some extent avoided. But you know, he lets you know all the way along that this war isn't going to be avoided. It's already happened. So I don't know. It's the entire 20th century regarded atemporally with humor and childish tangent.
Before it began, it's absurdist, it's fantasist, it's all over the place. It's got his usual collection of wild, sort of over-the-top names, Heino Vanderjuice and Pig Bodine comes back, and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of stories woven through here, even as the whole thing is kind of one great big zany wildness. And the message coming out of that, you draw back to this pre-trepidation of the 20th century, kind of a sense in his grasp of science and all the rest, that it could have been different, or a longing that it might have been different, but it wasn't.
A longing that it might have been different. That's perfect. And I think he actually said that in the jacket copy he wrote for his own book.
Yeah, this
says,
is where he says,
maybe it's not the world, but with a minor adjustment or two, it's what the world might be.
Let the reader decide, let the reader beware. A signed little PR blurb for his own book here, Thomas Pynchon.
Well, I mean, I don't think he could even expect his publicist to read it in time. So what else was he going to do?
Who else can write? It's all over the place in Siberia and Hollywood and old Mexico. The, I don't even know how to say it, Tunguska event is here. Where
the Tunguska event is real. It really happened.
Yes. This is the 800 square, what is it, miles or something?
Miles
of forest knocked
of
down in Siberia?
Flattened, but the explosion didn't create a crater. It didn't take place on the Earth. They think that some asteroid may have exploded 5 miles above the Earth, and the simple shock created all of that damage. But in the book, it turns out that the crater is transposed to the other hemisphere, and this affects the flight of the Chums of Chance. They have to go into an alternate world because there's something with the Tunguska event unlocks, you know, the end of the world or the beginning of the First World War, something like that. And there's even a suggestion that the dead of World War I are somehow contained in the crater, the invisible crater of the Tunguska event. I know it's a little, I don't mean to confuse anyone, so I better stop there.
Well, science is always there, though, and with its possibilities. The idea, as I read here, this is a century ago, that things could have gone differently, the sense that the world was being opened up by science, but it opened up ultimately in a particular way. Liesl, I know that, and you have my respect for this. You went back when you began to wade in here and decided you need to reread all the old ones. Can a new reader who hasn't been sort of caught up in the Pynchon magic from the 1960s or 70s jump in with Against the Day and get it?
You know, absolutely. This really is, I would call it a shorthand of everything he thinks, except that it's so long that would be
a long
oxymoronic.
Shorthand. Right.
A long shorthand. But it's just, it's unpacked. You know, it's kind of, I was thinking of a metaphor I could compare this to last night when I was skimming these yet again. And I was thinking of of Picasso's Guernica, just all this jumble of people and horses and bulls, and it's just all jumbled, and it's hard to, part of the fascination of it is that you can't make the sense of where anything is in relation to anything else. It's as if he had taken apart the individual players and put them in a line. So I don't know if that makes sense, but there's a way in which there's a more, every aspect is rendered distinctly, and then he weaves them together. But if you go back to, you know, V, which is absolutely phantasmagoric, you know, you really are kind of in medias res on every page, and and you don't know where you are. This really is linear. One thing that also comes to mind is that he has, on the very, the reason that I reread all the books is because on the very first page, he introduces one of the Met boys on the Chums of Chance, of the Chums of Chance in the airship. And he says, and the boy's name is Darby Suckling.
Yes.
Yet another fun pinchin' name.
Right.
And he says, as my faithful readers remember, that was the baby of the crew. And I was like, oh,
what?
No, I don't remember Darby Suckling.
Right.
And I just thought, I can't face these 1,100 pages not knowing if there's some reference to someone from Vineland or Crying of Lot 49.
But the joke was on you.
The joke was completely on me. Yeah.
You reread it all, and this was Darby's first appearance, in fact.
It was his first appearance.
I've been joined by Liesl Schillinger. She's a frequent reviewer for the New York Times Book Review, reviewed Against the Day. We're going to have a couple of top pinchin scholars on in just a second. But, Liesl, I wish you'd read something for us from Against the Day, whatever you like, that might sort of cue us off to the tone and texture of pinchin this time out. Have you got a little passage you could share with us?
Yes, I do. I wanted to read a passage that described the Chums of Chance, who are the carefree, ageless youths who sail above the world.
With their adventures referred to Chums of Chance at Krakatoa, the Chums of Chance on the Wrath of the Yellow Fang, all these references, but this time they're on this adventure, yeah?
Right, and rather early on in the book, before the war has actually begun, they meet a grim visitor from the future called a trespasser, and his name is Ryder Thorne, and he scolds them. And he tells them that they need to quit being so happy-go-lucky. And he says, and this is kind of the preface to the longer reading, but he says, "You children drift in a dream. All is smooth, no interruptions, no discontinuities. But imagine the fabric of time torn open and yourselves swept through with no way back, orphans and exiles who find you will do what you must, however shameful, to get from end to end of each corroded day. You are such simpletons at the fair, gawking at your wonders of science, expecting as your entitlement all the blessings of progress. It is your faith, your pathetic balloon boy faith."
Oh.
And now, that's, you know, that lets us understand that, you know, Pynchon himself understands the limitations of his boy crew. But I was touched later on in the book when the Chums of Chance have to take refuge from the real world that we know because of World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And this describes their flight on a great Saharan updrift into the counter-Earth. And it goes, "They were on the counter-Earth, on it and of it, yet at the same time also on the Earth they had never, it seemed, left. As if all maps and charts had suddenly become unreadable, the little company came to understand that in some way not exhausted by the geographical, they were lost. In the protracted journey which was to follow, covering eventually most of the world island, it would not escape the boys' attention that something very peculiar indeed was going on down on the surface. More and more often, detours became necessary. Entire blocks of sky were posted as off-limits. Now and then there would arrive, from nowhere immediately visible, great explosions of a deep and unprecedented intensity which caused structural members of the skycraft to groan and tremble." And they realize just how bad things are down below when the ships cook. Miles can't get champagne because the countryside is torn up with trenches. And, you know, he says, trenches? And so this is just the refuge into fantasy that Pynchon then wishes for the boys. He says, "May we imagine for them a vector passing through the invisible, the imaginary, the unimaginable, carrying them safely into this post-war Paris where the taxis now carry only lovers and cheerful drunks, and music which cannot be marched to goes on uninterrupted all night in the bars and the bal musette for the dancers who will always be there, and the nights will be dark enough for whatever visions must transpire across them, no longer to be broken into by light displaced from hell. and the difficulties they find are no more productive of evil than the opening and closing of too many doors or of too few, a vector through the night into a morning of hosed pavements, birds heard everywhere but unseen, bakery smells, filtered green light, a courtyard still in shade.
We could wish, Thomas Pynchon's wish for his Chums of Chance there. Liesl Schillinger, thanks for those readings. That's just terrific. That's from his latest, Against the Day. Liesl Schillinger gave it a great thumbs up in the New York Times. I want to turn now to two great Pynchon scholars, if I may. First, joining us from Ithaca, New York, chair of the English department at Cornell University, Thomas Pynchon's alma mater. We're joined by Molly Height. Professor Height, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Madison, Wisconsin, Thomas Schaub, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin there. He's author of Pynchon, The Voice of Ambiguity. Molly Height wrote Ideas of Order in the Novels of Thomas Pynchon. Professor Thomas Schaub, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Molly Height, we go first to you. You've got the alma mater there. You know, we'll have listeners who have been reading Thomas Pynchon for decades now, and at one time may even have identified themselves in this world by their identification with his books, and others who will know almost nothing about him. His sort of big name was a ways behind us now. I mean, he's your guy, but where do you stack him up? Is this one of our 20th century greats? Do you care to look at it that way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Not just me and not just Tom either, or the others of us who work on him. If you look at the 20th century, late 20th century figures who get written about and taught in academic classrooms, which is one of the ways that books stay in print, Pynchon and Toni Morrison, I think, are the clear front runners in the academic world, even though Pynchon's books are terrifically long. Well, so is Morrison's best book. And a long book is very hard to teach. But I think Pynchon has emerged over the years, being exactly what Tom and I back in the 80s were claiming, one of the truly great writers of this century.
And Thomas Schaub, if you were to boil down the meaning of Pynchon, Liesl Schillinger says it becomes more overt and clear, maybe too simple for some in this book, but how do you help do that for your students? How do you begin to orient them toward the voice, the message here?
So you give Molly the easy questions here.
Yeah, right. The big one comes your way. We'll come back to her.
I like to teach Pynchon as a imagination shaped by and helping to shape the 1960s. One thinks of the development of themes of conspiracy or the environmental movement that develops then. Pynchon is a great writer of alternative and underground histories, telling a different history from what one gets from mainstream histories of the 20th century. He's interested so much in what it is that has created the modern world and the conditions in which we live and the threats that we endure, that we the point of the past arc that threatens our heads. And so he comes out of this period, and I think he's tremendously useful to students to make them aware not only of the past that has made the present that they're occupying, but also in purely literary terms, providing them with a kind of a new model of what can go into a novel. Pynchon's books are full of a vast variety of registers of tone, style, parody, satire, elegy, cartoons, limericks, quasi-pornographic moments. It's just a real hash or a stew of riffs and burlesques that are brought together under, I think, Liesl is right to say, a kind of attack on the rationalism, the profit-making that has made life less than it might have been.
Molly Height, we'll throw you a tough one then as well. I mean, how do you describe the politics or the philosophy here? Is it first a political message or is it bigger than politics? I guess, but take us to his politics, if you could. Pynchon's politics, how do you boil them down?
Don't boil, but I think his politics are bigger than politics, but that's the best kind of politics. I think it's very interesting that in Against the Day, the name of the movement is anarchism, which for me begins to really allow me to think quite clearly about all sorts of the tendencies of his critique, which has been through his career, certainly from Gravity's Rainbow One, been enormous and powerful and very, very, very bitter. At the same time, it's brilliant and funny. Sense of in Against the Day, you see very clearly this association with, as Liesl says, American capitalism and the growth of technology, actually Western capitalism, the growth of Western technology in both the chemical developments that Pynchon is so wonderful at with dynamite and in the growth of electricity and the uses of electricity, and all these things kind of evolving in a kind of pattern that cuts out other options and opportunities. This is something actually he was very clear in Vineland, a novel that has been somewhat overlooked because it followed Gravity's Rainbow. Politically, Pynchon is extremely left. He's interested more and more, I think, in the history of the left, especially in the U.S. We saw that in Vineland, and it's picked up very much in Against the Day as a series of alternative worlds, alternative cultures. And Pynchon is so fundamentally a world maker. He's kind of utopian in that sense. He's always making worlds that are seductive and exciting and offer options that are also enormously seductive and exciting. It's that mystery that kind of permeates in all sorts of ways the worlds he creates, and that very much is present in Against the Day that I think is what pulls readers on rather than a kind of standard plot trajectory.
Liesl, early on in Against the Day, we have an example of this where arch-villain Scarsdale Vibe sits down with the Yale professor Heino van der Juice, and he's very upset, the arch-villain is, because there's a new form of free energy, electricity, being offered to the world that just taps into the Earth's resonance and would provide free energy to all. And he says, we just can't go down this road. I mean, I'm not quoting here, but essentially this would disrupt the very foundation of capitalism and everything we've fought so hard for. We've got to have a counter weapon to wipe this out. The politics right there early on.
The politics are there early on, and they continue all the way through. There is a marvelous speech by Scarsdale Vibe toward the end of the book, and I don't want to create a spoiler here by giving away more than that, but in which Scarsdale quite clearly lays out his anti-human self-advantaging goals, you know, that he's just out for himself, basically. But, you know, some people have talked about, some critics have asked whether this book is referring to current terrorism, and I wouldn't want to second-guess Pynchon that far, but it certainly reminds me of the Unabomber. I mean, the tone of there is so much time given to the question of the extent to which economic powers are subverting human freedoms, but as the scholars that as Tom and Molly can tell you, this is a theme that comes up from the first in Pynchon. I mean, this is revisited here, but it's one of his lasting preoccupations.
In this playful PR bit that he puts out in advance of the book, he writes, with a worldwide disaster looming just a few years ahead, it is a time, that is, in Against the Day, it is a time of unrestrained corporate greed, false religiosity, moronic fecklessness, and evil intent in high places. And then, Pynchon adds, no reference to the present day is intended or should be inferred. We want to talk a little about the reclusive life he's lived and why. We're going to hear the bits of Thomas Pynchon reading from The Simpsons, but a lot of listeners want to join us, and I want to begin to invite them in. Paul's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. And hi, everyone. I just wanted to talk about Gravity's Rainbow, mostly. I'm reading Against the Day right now, so I don't have too much to say about it right now. I'm enjoying it immensely.
Yeah.
And I'm actually an independent bookseller here in Boston, in Brookline, and I've been pushing this book into as many hands as I can.
Yeah.
But Gravity's Rainbow has been, I've read that maybe, I think, five times.
It's a long time since Gravity's Rainbow. Five reading. What has kept it so? With all the books to be read, what's kept this one there for you?
I'm only 29. It was pushed into my hands by my older brother, and I was coming out of reading Narnia and Tolkien obsessively when I was getting into high school, and this book came into my hands, and it was kind of the bridge into a more aware personality for me. I was able to kind of just dance along the top of it and skim it for enjoyment because he's just such a brilliantly entertaining writer. But I could feel these kind of movements below.
And is it Pynchon the fantasist that keeps you coming back then, Tolkien reader, or is it the politics beneath?
That was what hooked me, and then I had this sense of all of these great movements going on underneath, and that's what brought me back. I started to become much more curious.
So there's the love of it. Let's get one more view, if I may, from West Hartford, Connecticut. Polly's calling it. Paul, thanks for yours. Polly, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You asked previously whether people embraced him or ran from him, I believe was your words. And I was in college in the late 80s, an economics major in a liberal arts college with a lot of history, poli sci, English majors.
Yeah.
And it seemed as though everyone was reading him, and I thought, well, I want to be in the intellectual crowd. I'm definitely going to read some. Could not make my way through probably three of them, and literally felt as though I'm just never going to be in the intellectual crowd because I can't finish a Thomas Pynchon book.
Oh, don't be banished by Pynchon, but it was just too much.
It was just too much for me, and I think part of it was that I'm such a realist, and I had a hard time with all the fantasy. I couldn't bring it down to exactly what it was he was trying to convey to me, and now I have a daughter who's a very avid reader, and I actually want to have her give it a try because I'm thinking she may be able to get through it.
That's great. Polly, thanks for calling me. Turn to Molly Height on that. Molly, in your experience, you know, what kind of reader gets engrossed in Pynchon, and what kind just can't get away quickly enough?
That's kind of hard because, as you know, I'm at a university. I make people read things. They don't always like it. Before that, however, I stumbled on V and the Crying of Lot 49 before I did go to college. Mm. And, in fact, I was in a group of people who were all over the place, young people, but pizza delivery man, waitresses. We all just loved Pynchon, and when Gravity's Rainbow came out, it was like something we would meet after hours at bars, you know, and read aloud and talk about. So I suspect, and I'm going to hold out for this, the readership is a lot more vast than sometimes as academics we know about or want to maintain.
And Tom Schaub, is there still, I mean, Polly felt like, our caller Polly felt, if she couldn't read Thomas Pynchon, she couldn't be an intellectual. Is that still out there as a marker, or is that history now?
Well, I don't know that reading Pynchon determines whether or not you're an intellectual. But I do have students who even my own partner, finds that she cannot make her way through Pynchon. And it may have something to do with fantasy. It may have to do with the lack of the conventional plotting that people look for to see what's going to happen next, and they become involved in a particular character.
We've got a terrific panel with us here, Lisa Schillinger. She reviewed the book for the New York Times, Against the Day, the latest. Molly Height is with us. She's chairman of the English department at Cornell University, where Thomas Pynchon attended college. And Thomas Schaub is here from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, author of Pynchon, The Voice of Ambiguity. Famously reclusive, the rumor he is J.D. Salinger out there, or he's like J.D. Salinger. Very, very few appearances over the years, a couple of famous ones. On, of all things, The Simpsons, both in 2004. I want to give you the voice of Thomas Pynchon now. This is from a 2004 Simpsons episode, Diatribe of a Mad Housewife. Thomas Pynchon's cartoon figure appears with a paper bag over his head. In this episode, Marge writes a novel, and she and her publicist look to Pynchon for a blurb on the book jacket.
Marge, this is the best first novel my assistant has ever summarized for me. Now, all we need are some endorsements from famous writers.
Here's your quote. Thomas Pynchon loved this book almost as much as he loves cameras. Hey, over here, have your picture taken with a reclusive author. Today only, we'll throw in a free autograph.
So out of hiding, or sort of out of hiding, Thomas Pynchon there on The Simpsons. And here's one more from All's Fair in Oven War. Thomas Pynchon shows up again with a paper bag over his head. Here, Lisa Simpson asks him to try some chicken wings Marge cooked in her new kitchen.
What do you think, Thomas Pynchon?
These wings are delicious. I'll put this recipe in the Gravity's Rainbow Cookbook, right next to the frying of Latke 49.
And out he comes, or sort of. Thomas Schaub, why a recluse all these years, and just how reclusive?
Well, I think he's... I remember when Gravity's Rainbow was published that there was an effort on the part of Time magazine and Life and other media institutions that wanted to interview him, get hold of him, and could not. And... even efforts to look into his background often turned up a registrar who wouldn't turn over papers and so on. And I think that Pynchon had from early on decided that he wanted to maintain a kind of privacy from the public world of the Republic. And we see this theme, actually, of withdrawal as a kind of a possession, a way of having something that couldn't be taken away by the powers of government and monopoly. And I think that he saw also, as he matured, that the ways in which Mailer's persona had been taken over by the media.
Norman Mailer just sort of robbed away from him.
And Mailer has always had to deal with that. He talks about it at the beginning of Armies of the Night. Mm-hmm. Pynchon has determined not to become that kind of public Hemingway-like writer.
I think that's
a kind of a political stance on his part.
And maybe necessary for the counter view of history to keep it going. I don't know. Molly Hite, what do we know about the Pynchon biography? What's on the record? He was at your school. He went off and worked as a technical writer for... he studied science and then majored in English at Cornell, and then...
Right. Well, then I'm not as sure as he went to Seattle for a couple of years and worked for Boeing as a technical writer. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Mexico. And we have now some letters that he wrote to Kirkpatrick and Faith Sale, friends of his from Cornell. Mm-hmm. Faith Sale was later his editor for Gravity's Rainbow. And those letters are at the University of Texas that tell us a little bit. I'm more on the Cornell end, although I came here long after he left.
Right. Lives, we understand, in Manhattan, and I guess that's no secret. 1990, Liesl, you remind us, the famously solitary Pynchon married his literary agent, Melanie Jackson. 1991, had a son, Jackson, whose bio is in Facebook now, famously. You can learn a little about the son, if not the father. Tom Schaub, you had a kind of encounter with Thomas Pynchon, or maybe not. Tell us that story. It's a great one.
It's hard to say. You know, when I was studying Pynchon for my dissertation, my director asked me, are any of the names in this book historical figures or actual names from public life? And I kind of laughed it off. I said, Sherm, Blodgett Waxwing? That can't possibly be an actual name. But he suggested that I look into phone books, and I developed a habit of checking out phone books wherever I was. And about a year later, I was at my brother's house in Berkeley,
California,
for the 1975 Modern Language Association. Mm. And I was making a pot of coffee and opened up the Berkeley phone book and found that Tyrone Slothrop, who is the hero or the central figure of Gravity's Rainbow, was living on South Bancroft in Berkeley, California.
Or so the phone book said.
Just sent prickles up and down my spine. I thought, my God, is this Pynchon taking out a phone under the name of one of his characters? So I sent a postcard to Tyrone Slothrop.
Right.
It was very bizarre. Kind of. This was in the early days, you know, before theory had taken over.
Yeah.
And this was, when I look back on it, I think of this as... kind of the fun of literary study in the late 60s, early 70s. And I sent him a postcard and gave him my phone number, and he He called me up on Christmas Day. The family was seated around the table, and my mother took the call.
He being whoever responded at Tyrone Slothrop's address.
That's right. And mother put her hand over the mouthpiece and said to me, "It's him." I just broke out into a sweat. I mean, because Pynchon was at this time just so notoriously reclusive. So he invited me down to his bungalow at 836 South Bancroft.
In Berkeley,
and we played bridge that afternoon.
And did he wear a name tag that said, "Hello, my name is Thomas Pynchon, Tyrone Slothrop, anonymous"?
He did not. In fact, as we played bridge that afternoon on a king-size bed with black sheets,
right,
the entirety of the living room that we were staying in was draped in black curtains. I would ask him questions about Gravity's Rainbow, and he seemed to have all the answers. And at one point he said to me, "You don't think I'm Thomas Pynchon, do you?" And I said, well, you know, how could I tell? And he said, "Well, I guess you couldn't." And
and there you are.
There you are. So several years later, I'm in a bar in Waterville, Maine, talking to Robert Gillespie, who was a roommate of Pynchon's at Cornell University. And I told Gillespie this story. And Gillespie said, "You know, I think you played bridge with Thomas Pynchon." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Well, in the rooming house that Pynchon lived in, he had a king-size bed in there with black sheets, and the windows were hung in black drapes."
Wow. So maybe. You sprawled across the king-size bed with the postmodern master.
It seems unlikely to me even today, and yet there's, you know, this odd feeling that perhaps he was hanging out in Berkeley.
I would love to hear, in the time we've got, a reading from each of you, Amali and Thomas. Liesl Schillinger was good enough to share something from the new book, Against the Day. You've read Pynchon for so long. I'd love to know what you'd most like to share. Amali, do you have something from one of his books you might share with us there that you could set up?
Tom grabbed Gravity's Rainbow.
Okay, so where are you?
We're both nuts about Gravity's Rainbow. Yeah. But I thought I'd pick out a little piece from Vineland because there's so much connection for me between Vineland and Against the Day.
It's 1990, Vineland, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This was the book that followed Gravity's Rainbow and aroused a lot of disappointment because it wasn't Gravity's Rainbow, a terrible act to follow, an impossible act. Mm. But it was quite a wonderful book in its own right, and I've since taught it a lot and come to really, really, really love it.
Give us a taste.
This is a very short passage, which I think kind of gives you what I'm seeing as the anarchist flavor of so much of his work. It's about marijuana growers in Northern California and a vision of the state that is the United States, that state in the Reagan era, that was to come, that was planning to come, the totalitarian state of the U.S. And we should remember that Pynchon wrote a really wonderful introduction to George Orwell's 1984. That's one of the things about celebrity for Pynchon. I think celebrity is surveillance.
Right. And, let us hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. But anyway, okay, this is about marijuana growers. Holy Tail is a particular farm. Sooner or later, Holy Tail was due for the full treatment from which it would emerge, like most of the old Emerald Triangle, pacified territory, reclaimed by the enemy for a timeless, defectively imagined future of zero-tolerance, drug-free Americans, all pulling their weight and all locked into the official economy, inoffensive music, endless family specials on the tube, church all week long, and on special days, for extra good behavior, maybe a cookie.
That's from Vineland, 1990. And Tom Schaub, you've got something from Gravity's Rainbow we should share with us.
I do. This is from the Advent chapter or scene in Gravity's Rainbow when Roger and Jessica go into the countryside to attend a church service for Advent. And in the midst of this service, which is about five or six pages long, Pynchon drifts into one of his typical riffs. And this riff, it gives you an idea of kind of alternative history, a sense of the collusion between war and economics. And I love it largely for its language.
Mm.
Listen, this is the war's even song, the war's canonical hour, and the night is real. Hull plates swing in the sky like great iron leaves on cables that creak in splinters of sound. In the pipe fitters' sheds, icicled, rattling when the gales are in the streets. Here's thousands of old used toothpaste tubes, heaped often to the ceilings, thousands of somber man mornings made tolerable, transformed to mint fumes and bleak song that left white spots across the quicksilver mirrors from Harrow to Gravesend, thousands of children who pestled foam up out of soft mortars of mouths, who lost easily 1,000 times as many words among the chalky bubbles, uncounted soapy licorice moments spat and flushed down to sewers in the slow scumming gray estuary, the morning mouths growing with the day tobacco and fish furred, down to become dusty oversized bubbles tessellating tough and stagnant among the tar shorelines, the intricate draftsmanship of outlets feeding, multiplying out to sea, as one by one these old toothpaste tubes are emptied and returned to the war.
Wow. Tessellating, tough, and stagnant. Thomas Schaub reading there, reading Thomas Pynchon from Gravity's Rainbow. We've had so many callers. Once again, let me try and get a couple. Bruce is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
That's such... If it isn't the writing that hooks people, I have a thought that might. I wrote a thesis in 1982 on Gravity's Rainbow, and I was shocked, but not too shocked, to hear you guys say, Tom say, that there may be people who don't even know this guy, especially among perhaps younger readers. I mean, I was with somebody yesterday who said, "Who's Neil Young?" And I was like, oh, God.
It is 2006 now, Bruce.
Well, so I have, here's the hook.
Yep.
I think that the generation now that is so non-linear in the way it takes in information,
mm-hmm.
and so channel surfing in the way that it experiences the channels of life, this stuff is custom made for them. They should feel very at home, flipping
mm-hmm.
through.
So dive right in, you say. It's a great observation, Bruce, and thanks for it. Liesl, is that you saying hear, hear?
I was going to ask Tom and Molly about that, because when I first read some of these 20 years ago, I found it really challenging. It was like putting hot sauce on your tongue, like a test of literary manhood to read it. Going back to it now, after Arrested Development and
yeah.
The Simpsons and the way we all watch and read and genre jump, this is not as mind-bending as it's, I think, seemed when it first came out in the 60s and 70s. What do they think?
Molly, are we catching up with Thomas Pynchon in that way as a culture, maybe?
I think my students have told me this over and over. I long ago stopped dealing with Gravity's Rainbow in terms of violations of conventions
yeah.
because as somebody told me, and this was ages ago, said, you know, we watch MTV. These aren't violations.
Quick cuts are our life. Tom Schaub, how about it? For a new generation, Gravity's Rainbow the place to jump in or Against the Day? What do you say for Thomas Pynchon?
I generally recommend The Crying of Lot 49, which I think of as being a book on a par with The Great Gatsby or Benito Cereno. It's such a parable of American culture and American expectation and question about its own meaning. But, you know, I have to, if I may, just read one of Pynchon's limericks.
We've got half a minute. Be quick.
Oh, every little Nazi's shooting pool or playing potsy on the middle work. All the funny fascists just a-twirling their mustaches. Where are we going? Can you guess? I'll stop there. But just, you know, you can jump in anywhere and just enjoy the heck out of this book.
You can, and maybe custom made for a generation that jumps in anywhere and everywhere as a daily habit. What a pleasure to get to dive into Thomas Pynchon again with the new book. And after all this time, we're so grateful to each of you for being here. Liesl Schillinger, thanks for the review, and thank you very much for being with us today. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Molly Height, chair of the English department at Cornell, author of Ideas of Order in the novels of Thomas Pynchon. Professor Height, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
And Thomas Schaub at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Pynchon, The Voice of Ambiguity is his book. Professor Schaub, thanks very much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.